Okay, we are back to paper three, section three now. And that's old single column, page 48. Let's see, we can just jump right in. Who'd like to? You want to read? Okay. Take the high road around. Okay, so paper three, section three. I think the only thing we need is an upfront here, little note. Just remember this sequence that they're stepping through in these first three sections. So we had omnipresence, and then we had omnipotence, and now omniscience, obviously. So continuing with that, those are, they put the three omnis up front, and then they go from there. So like I said last week, just always keep in mind how they're building, because that's very helpful to not, especially when we're doing it like this and breaking it up, literally one section a night, and a week in between, it can, you can kind of forget, and you don't want to break it up into such a disjoint thing. You want to try to remind yourself of what they're hoping that you have fresh in your mind each time. So let's see what they say about omniscience.
God's universal knowledge. God knows all things. The divine mind is conscious of and conversant with the thought of all creation. His knowledge of events is universal and perfect. The divine entities going out from him are a part of him. He who balances the clouds is also perfect in knowledge. The eyes of the Lord are in every place. Said your great teacher of the insignificant sparrow, one of them shall not fall to the ground without my Father's knowledge. And also, the very hairs of your head are numbered. He tells the number of the stars. He calls them all by their names. The Universal Father is the only personality in all the universe who does actually know the number of the stars and the planets of space. All the worlds of every universe are constantly within the consciousness of God. He also says, I have surely seen the affliction of my people. I have heard their cry, and I know their sorrows. For the Lord looks from heaven. He beholds all the sons of men from the place of his habitation. He looks upon all the inhabitants of the earth. Every creature child may truly say, he knows the way I take, and when he has tried me, I shall come forth as gold. God knows our down-sittings and our uprisings. He understands our thoughts afar off and is acquainted with all our ways. All things are naked and open to the eyes of him with whom we have to do. And it should be a real comfort to every human being to understand that he knows your frame. He remembers that you are dust. Jesus, speaking of the living God, said, your Father knows what you have need of even before you ask him.
Okay, so there he goes again, putting together a whole sequence of Bible quotes. A couple things I want to bring out there. Let's start with his invocations of Psalms here. So he quotes Psalms there. He tells the number of the stars and calls them all by their names, and then he puts in some very specific clarity. The Universal Father is the only personality in all the universe who does actually know the number of the stars and planets of space. Okay? When you see an only, you better ask yourself why. I mean, especially when you have very, very specific sentences like that. Those are good ones to start with the why question. I mean, obviously you want to ask why on every sentence, but you know, those are always good ones to start with, because that's going to bring something into you know, real sharp focus. You can understand why and only is in play. You know, so your first thought is, well, what about the eternal Son and the infinite Spirit? You know, maybe others or something. I mean, you know, why? Why is the universal Father the only personality that would have such knowledge? So at, you know, up at the absolutes, we have the Isle of Paradise and the Eternal Son and the Infinite Spirit, the Universal Father. And this whole issue of, okay, know the number of the stars and planets of space. We're not talking about the people on planets or anything like that, just the objects, matter. Okay? So think about the logical relationship of those four absolute actuals. Okay, so you have the Isle of Paradise. You know that every ultimaton of every star, planet, you know, you name it, every material thing, every energy phenomena, the Isle of Paradise is the foundation of all of that. The Isle of Paradise is directly in contact with all physical energy phenomena. And who's behind the Isle? The Father. And of course, specifically, you know, now that we, you know, have really begun to clarify those six different facets of the Father, you know, when you're talking about God the Father knowing the number of the stars and planets of space, you know, which aspect of God the Father is directly engaging the Isle? It's not the universal Father, it's the universal controller, right? So, you know, the universal controller aspect of God the Father through the Isle of Paradise has direct consciousness of every, you know, physical energy phenomenon, and certainly every star and planet. Okay, now why not the other two? Well, you know, the eternal Son is to the side of the Isle, logically, in relationship. You know, it's only the Father that's behind, and the infinite Spirit's in front of. You know, the Isle and the Son are really coming to a focus in the third source and center, and you know, that's the point of action. That's the God of action. So even though you have those coordinate personalities, with their absoluteness and infiniteness, or infinity, you can just say, you know, only one of the three personalities is behind the Isle and can see through the Isle to, you know, see through, quote unquote, through the Isle to know this. So that's specifically why. It's just a simple little statement of the logical relationship of the absolutes to one another. You know, who has that direct access? Only the Father. So when you think about that, you know, that logical recognition about the absolutes, you know, the relationship between the absolutes, you know, think again about that other quote at the end of the second paragraph from Psalms. He knows your frame. He remembers that you are dust. Make that poetic, famous poetic line have a whole new depth of meaning to it. Okay, literally, every dust grain, you know, every automaton, the Father through the Isle is conscious of every single automaton individually.
Yeah. True meaning of having a lot on your mind.
Right? All right. You know, just to think about what the consequences of infinity are, okay? He very, very intimately, more intimately than any human has ever imagined, knows that you are dust. He's directly conscious of every, you know, individuation of your physical nature. He couldn't be more intimately aware of where you are. Remember, and that's what we've been pointing out. That's how the Father directly gets his hand on you, as it were. The universal controller is that relationship between that which acts and that which results. All those results, you know, he's in direct relationship to them as the universal controller. You know, specifically here through the aisle. Okay, so just want to make sure you appreciated that. And now the other thing in the middle there, that little quote from Job, I think would be a fun one to think about a little bit more. Sort of right in the middle of that second paragraph. He knows the way I take, and when he has tried me, I shall come forth as gold. When he has tried me. Wanted to pick that up because it ties into what we spent a fair amount of time last week talking about. You know, so, you know, they're invoking that line from Job, you know, as a reminder that every celestial being is tested. You know, not just those of us who are mortals on these mortal spheres. All celestial beings are tested. Everyone has to choose eternity. There's no automatic relationship to eternity. Everyone has to choose it. And you think back to that one spot that we were, you know, working on a bit last week, when they're talking about trying to understand how God appears. You know, when you begin to look around the universe and trying to understand, okay, now I know there's a God and I know he's behind this universe, but I'm having a really hard time understanding how I relate all of the very troublesome things that I see to my ideal, which has to be a fact, that, you know, of God's, you know, infinite perfection and love and et cetera. And there was that that one point where they really brought it to a head. Let's see if I can find it here. Where was that? Therefore, to you, the creature, many of the acts of the all-powerful Creator seem to be arbitrary, detached, and not infrequently heartless and cruel. Now, first of all, as we were talking about that, remember the point I was bringing up last week. I mean, if you are recognizing the actual God, this will be your experience. Why? Because God is infinite. Look at the title of that section, God's Infinite Power. God is infinite. We're very finite. There has to be a differential there. Okay? There has to be all differential. Okay? Infinite, finite. So, I mean, if you aren't having this experience, you know, where a lot of the observations you make are not infrequently heartless and cruel, you know, to all appearances. If you're not having that experience, okay, there can be only two things in play. Either there isn't the differential, you're infinite also, and you're in clear understanding of God's infinity. There's no, you know, misunderstanding in play. Well, okay, that doesn't seem too likely, unless I'm really self-righteous. I would think I'm infinite. More likely, it's the other way around. Instead of you lifting yourself up to some notion of infinity, you've brought God down to your level of the finite. You know, if your notion of God never has this conflict of, you know, it doesn't, you know, notice what it says. You remember I pointed this out last week. It doesn't say, you know, the apparent acts of the all-powerful Creator. It says the acts of the all-powerful Creator seem, not infrequently, heartless and cruel. The actual, you know, God is acting And you can't help but, you know, if you have a recognition of the infinite God, to interpret those acts that way. If you don't have that conflict, you've got some finite, fanciful, completely, you know, you can wrap your mind completely around this God. There's no mystery in him at all. Everything he does is all fuzzy and soft, from all appearances, you know, and you like that God because it's very easy. You don't like the prickly God. I assure you that this is not true. In infinity, he's not heartless and cruel. Of course. But that's the way it will appear because of the differential. You know, and so when you think about, you know, the book of Job, you know, this is, of course, a lot about what the book of Job is, you know, is wrestling with, is this apparent, heartless, cruel expression of the God who is love. And, I mean, take it a notch further. You know, you got this one quote from Job. You know, they even have it in a spot up in the book. And if you go up to, see, what is this? Up in the religion papers, up to paper 101, section 3. And you don't have to go there, but just to know where I'm getting this from. I don't know if you remember up there in that religion paper, there's a long list of 12 items that starts out, genuine spiritual faith, true moral consciousness is revealed in that it, and then 1, 2, 3, 4, yeah. Number 12, so it's revealed in that it goes right on worshiping God in spite of anything and everything, dares to declare, even though he slay me, yet will I serve him. Another classic line from Job. Okay. Not just, you know, not just the milder one, you know, when he has tried me, but even though he slay me, yet will I serve him. And that's an important step. I mean, notice how, to get to the point where you dare to declare that. And I mean, at some point, if you're going to come to terms with reality, you have to come to terms with the fact that God kills every one of us. He doesn't murder us, of course not, but he does kill every one of us. You know, and I say, well, that doesn't make sense. Then what does the word kill mean? It means cause to die. Okay, every one of us dies. Who causes that? But you know, if God didn't want that, he could have set it up so that you didn't have that freedom to help it along. No matter how you approach it, God is causing you to die. You're designed to die. It's part of the process. You know, and to say it directly, even though it's like, you know, people avoid saying that because it sounds just too difficult. I don't want to think of that God kills me. Well, I mean, that's mild compared to the line they're just holding up there from Job. Slay is a stronger word than kill. Even though he slay me. You know, not just kill me, slay me, yet while I serve him. So just, I mean, not to overdo this, but it is an important step. You can see they're really putting this forward in a lot of places in the book, trying to get us to develop a relationship with an infinite God, which is going to be fraught with infinite mysteries. You're not going to tie a nice little tidy bow of happiness around an infinite God. We're finite. There's going to be an infinite number of things that are going to be incomprehensible if you actually recognize an infinite God. And it's important to take that step because the God that you need to choose that can get you to eternity is not the little finite God of our happy fabrication. It's the infinite God of infinite mystery and infinite power. There's a reason why they quote a lot from Job. You know, and they also quote a lot from Psalms. You know, it's twice, you know, here. The soaring recognition of the truth, beauty, goodness, and love of God, you know, is there in Isaiah and in Psalms. And they quote that a lot to remind you of that. But notice equally, they're trying to get you to face facts. You know, not just take the fuzziness from Psalms and Isaiah and make a nice little happy finite God and believe in that God. You know, we all need to stop believing. We need to start recognizing. We need to have faith in the God and have our beliefs predicated on that faith, that recognition of the infinite God with his infinite mystery, and to believe that yet, though he slay me, he loves me. And because he loves me, I will serve him. Yeah, Jason?
I think there's other antidotes, too, that you can bring up. The one thing is, you know, why does God allow all this suffering in the
mm-hmm.
world?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the answer to that is free will. And then, of course, you could also say that Jesus said that not all of us will die. So in truth, we'll never die, but it's the fact that our bodies die.
Right.
So there's two things that I think of.
Right, sure. I mean, we all know how you begin to. But, you know, humans have been using those thoughts for a long time, but they've been doing it with a finite God. It's too easy with a finite God to rationalize around these problems. That's one of the points they're trying to make. They want you to get a hold of the infinite God where you can't rationalize around him. You cannot get yourself into a warm, cozy state. Good tidings of affirmation and joy. The point is to confront the tension. Develop a relationship with the tension. And discover the gifts that you've been given that allow you to live in that tension. If you don't embrace the tension, you never embrace the gifts that God has given you to live in that tension. You dumb yourself down below the tension, and you're only an animal down there. The gifts that allow you to deal with that tension are the true, real gifts from God. They're not just fancy animal behavior, clever rationalization schemes and stuff. So effort, struggle, conflict, faith, determination, love, loyalty, and progress. You want to get to the progress. You have to use the Father's gifts to get to the progress. In order to get to need the Father's gifts, you have to get to conflict. Right. You have to embrace the tension and then use the Father's gifts to live in that tension. Become a dynamic living phenomenon in the cosmos. There's a couple of things there. See, one is, like I was saying, very much wanting you to hearken back and re-engage again those difficult statements that they put out in the previous section in dealing with omnipotence. But also, you notice how many times in what we've been reading here, they are trying to get us to recognize the impersonal hand of the Father, the universal controller. Now, not just the universal Father. God the Sevenfold is a twofold downreach by the Father. Universal Father and universal controller. It's not just one or the other. It's both. And it's to just allow the Father the universal Father to also be the universal controller at the same time gives him so much more depth. It's not just a personal encirclement way up there above matter, mind, and even spirit, you know, really. It's just way up there in the ethereal domains of personality. He's rock solid on every automaton. He's literally conscious of every automaton in your body, knows you that intimately. You know? And then he reaches out with that hand of love.
Now for the other two members of the Trinity to access that, he has to share that knowledge.
Right.
But they don't have it innately.
They can know about it. Yeah. They can't know it. Only he, like I said, he's the only personality that can know it. Yeah. All others can only know about it. Because he passes that down. Yeah. All right.
God is possessed of unlimited power to know all things. His consciousness is universal. His personal circuit encompasses all personalities, and his knowledge of even the lowly creatures is supplemented indirectly through the descending series of divine sons and directly through the indwelling thought adjusters. And furthermore, the infinite spirit is all the time, everywhere, present.
Okay, several little things in that. It's an action-packed, tiny little paragraph there. Just reminding you of a few other asides, like the descending sons and the thought adjusters. And also, the infinite spirit. Why did they bring that up? When we're talking about consciousness, the infinite spirit is the infinite mind. So that's obviously a big consciousness avenue into the cosmos. And so you can start to think about it's like, what's the difference between the consciousness that the infinite mind has and the consciousness that the first source and center has? And but obviously, no matter what those differences, you can begin to recognize who is behind all of that. The first source and center. So he has access to all of that through them. He may not literally himself be the infinite mind, but he's behind the infinite mind. Now, just notice, that we recognized how they were invoking the universal controller. The very next paragraph is his personal circuit encompasses all personalities. They remind you of the universal father and his personality circuit. So on top of having this direct omniscience through the eyes of the universal controller, all the personalities that are out there, on top of that, he has an additional personal consciousness of all the personalities. And that's why very much for us, you have both in play because of the sevenfold is how he's engaging us.
It's almost like he's coming out from paradise and he's like setting the bounds on both sides, the upper bounds and the lower bounds, from what you're describing. The controller at the very bottom.
Right.
And the personality at the very top.
Yes, definitely.
Spirit.
Right. He's the initiator.
And everything else he allows, he delegates everything in between.
Yeah, in many ways, yes. And to the extent to which you understand the nature of reality as some sort of a hierarchy of matter, mind, spirit, personality, if that's the picture, then it has two endpoints. The initiator had to have touched those two endpoints. The father had, that's exactly what you're just recognizing. It's like, if it's a logical picture, depiction of reality, the initiator should be obvious where the initiator touches it. He initiates the bottom and the top, and then everything in between, is. And again, notice the order. We just like they put deity before God, clear up in the forward there in defining them. They could have talked about the universal father, and then, alluded to the universal controller. But they didn't, because it's important to understand logically, just like I've been trying to stress. He can't find you directly with the universal father, his universal father facet. Okay, that's the relationship of that which acts to itself. It's not the relationship of that which acts to that which results. You're a result. He has to find you first, and then, having found you, he can put you into the father's, the universal father's circuit.
And he finds you by finding where your individuality is.
Yeah. Of course, for us, you know, you literally can think of it as matter, but of course, it's you know, abstract that. You know, he finds all beings this way. They're, all beings are individuations. You know, he's the individuality of the parts. Mm-hmm. You know, like the mother's the individuality of the whole. You know, so you know, he engages each part separately. That's the only way he only engages as an on an individual to individual basis. And it's like, you know, he engages each automaton individually. each person individually. No collectiveness.
I think you're one of the few, if only, that have recognized this.
It's all about beginning to really carefully recognize what the fundamental differences are between what's being revealed and what humans have always known. If it's something that humans have always known, and it's really straightforward, it's not too likely they're going to spend much precious real estate in the book talking about that. If they've taken up space, you know, they're trying to describe infinity and they only have 2,000 pages, they're going to be very discriminating in what they spend their time on in a sentence. And it's not going to be yada, 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 yada. You know, if they're saying something, it's most likely distinctly revelatory and cutting right down through all kinds of things that you thought you had all tidy, you know, in your mind. You know, and you have to allow the revelation to do that, to reach in and make all things new. And so it's just, you know, that's what you're looking for, a radically different perspective on the nature of God and your relationship to that God, a perspective that allows all of the old difficulties to melt away so that you don't, you know, aren't just the next generation of humans chasing their tails about this whole God notion. We can finally break free and start to progress. Okay, so Universal Controller, Universal Father, and then what do they say?
We are not wholly certain as to whether or not God chooses to foreknow events of sin. But even if God should foreknow the free will acts of his children, such foreknowledge does not in the least abrogate their freedom. One thing is certain, God is never subjected to surprise.
Okay. So now, here's a great example of, you know, I mean, this is, you know, this sort of a little thought, you know, humans have been chasing around for ages. This whole bit about God's foreknowledge and all that sort of stuff. Okay, the big problem there is the time viewpoint. Okay, foreknow, that's a time viewpoint word. Is God in time? Is the Father, you know, God the Father in time? No. God the Father is in eternity. He's not in time. That word is meaningless from his viewpoint. I mean, we can wrestle with ways to kind of find some rationalization of our viewpoint, the time viewpoint. But why don't we start by just understanding, recognizing the eternity viewpoint, how it actually is from his perspective. And there is no such thing as foreknowledge. I mean, when he looks at infinity reality, he's looking at all of the finite, all of the absolute, all the co-absolute, all the past, all the present, all the future, all at once. Okay? There is no past, present, future. There is no finite, absolute, you know, co-absolute. I mean, he engages it all at once. From, you know, from within eternity.
So he sees us as finalities already.
Yeah, he sees everything as more. I mean, see, he doesn't just see you at an endpoint. He sees you, all of you. See, you know, we all think of ourselves as a point moving through time. It's like, well, does God see me the way I was yesterday, or how I am today, or does he see me as I'm going to be tomorrow? Yes. He can't do anything except see all of you independent of time and space. something which is, you know, completely beyond our ability to directly consciousize. So, I mean, you know, humans have started to think about it. So, you know, you can do this. That's what I'm saying. That's why we can think about this eternity viewpoint. Just stop for a second and think about the way he sees such things. Okay, the question they're asking is, so you notice the sequence here. Okay, it's like, okay, we did the whole material thing in the universal controller, and then they reminded us of how he knows us also as personalities. It's like, well, but personalities can choose iniquity. So how does that work? Okay, well, if you think about it from the Father's point of view, you have the whole thing in front of you. And in terms of this direct personal consciousness, you can maybe think of him, you know, weaving threads of awareness down into this whole. Past, present, future, finite, absolute, absolute, the whole thing. He's weaving threads of consciousness into that. And the question there, see, the question they're really asking is not foreknowledge. The question they're asking is, if, you know, he's conscious of this personality thread, I mean, does he does he allow his awareness to go down the rabbit hole with a person? If a person, you know, chooses unreality, you know, so that, you know, this is what they're wondering, is it's all there. Does he thread his consciousness into those dark channels or not? You know, and they're saying, we're not wholly certain. Okay. You know, whether or not, you know, he actually brings his knowingness into those segments of unreality, you know, as it were. But regardless of whether he does that or not, God is obviously never subjected to surprise, because there's no time thing, you know, involved. He sees the whole picture. Okay, so surprise, again, it's, that doesn't make any sense from an eternity viewpoint. Yep.
I remember back in paper, either 117 or 118, we had a discussion where God knew if we were going to make it or not, like if we were going to choose iniquity or not.
Well, again, see, just this whole bit about, you know, we've struggled mightily a number of times trying to think about how to understand iniquity, you know, and keeping it within the finite. It's like, well, okay, so we have, you know, it's a binary phenomenon, and you're either upheld as a person by the personal purposive aspect of God the Supreme, upheld by God the Mother, or that, you know, that individuality evaporates and that purposing, that personality goes into God the Almighty, the power pattern aspect of God the Supreme down in the finite. And we've talked about that. But, you know, what we're trying to do here is, rather than trying to sort out all those details in time with the God that's in time, God the Supreme, you know, start with God the Father and, you know, get that understood, you know, from the, so get the understanding from the highest level first.
Right, that's,
yeah. Right, now we're talking about, yeah, infinite deity. What's the viewpoint there? And I want to remind you, if you go back to the previous paper, remember when they were helping us to rethink the old notion about God loves the sinner and hates the sin, you know, and how it's like, well, not quite, you know, if you think about it more precisely. And, you know, remember that one statement they had in there where it says, God loves the sinner because he is a personality reality, potentially eternal. While towards sin, God strikes no personal attitude. For sin is not a spiritual reality. It is not personal. Therefore, does only the justice of God take cognizance of its existence? So now, see, put these two things together. I mean, this is one of the things that the relators are thinking about. It's like, well, okay, we know that, you know, the sin itself, you know, God takes no personal attitude towards that. So when we're thinking about this personal consciousness threading down in, you know, that would seem to say, well, that seems to say that maybe he doesn't go into those little dark segments of the thread. But then, of course, there's the sinner, and well, it's kind of confusing. See, that's what there's. This is the kind of things that they're thinking about. They're trying to figure out. It's like, well, how do you think about that? But you can at least begin to appreciate what they're wrestling with, rather than just shrugging your shoulders and, well, these, you know, crazy divine counselors and all the highfalutin things they spend their time thinking about. I don't understand. But you know, I mean, you can appreciate it in just the last these two papers. You can really see where, you know, the curiosity comes from. You know, if he takes no personal attitude, you know, there's no personal consciousness of sin, you know, that's just, you know, the Trinity, you know, or at the same time, the universal controller hand of the Father. But it's like, well, but if the universal controller hand of the Father knows it, wouldn't that mean that the universal Father hand would have to know it too? I mean, he's not schizophrenic. That's what they're wrestling with. They can't figure out how to think about it.
Aren't rebellious spirits or rebellious personalities detained in the Father's worlds?
Sure. Yeah.
So it's almost like the Father takes these, when people have gone outside the bounds of all the other creators and controllers of the universe, the only one left for them is like that personality connection with the Father. You know, and I guess once that gets severed through iniquity, you know, there's nothing left.
Well, you know, I mean, it's always the case that, remember the times when they point out that the Father can always intervene relative to delegated issues. And of course, the most, you know, significant time that occurs is when one of those individuals he's delegated to has dropped the ball. You know, if a planetary prince drops the ball, you know, don't be surprised if it's the Father that steps in directly. Remember, that's right before the inevitabilities. We're coming up on that now, on the inevitability section. They talk about that. You have this very definitive hierarchical delegating, you know, and it's the buck stops with the Father in those things. You know, when he delegates it. You know,
so. I like what John's alluding to, though. I've never thought of that in quite that way. You know, the last ditch effort as well, you know, the last bit of mercy for these iniquitous personalities is to rub it right in their noses. Hey, look, we believe in the Father. We're putting you right on the Father's world. What, you know? Check that out. What do you think? You think we're playing games here?
Yeah, and just to remind them of, well, okay, so you can reject finite personality with the finite dimensions of your, I mean, finite mercy with the finite dimensions of your personality. Mm-hmm. You can reject absentite mercy with the absentite dimensions of your personality. But like you're saying, you know, the final thread is, okay, put you on the Father's world, okay, you've got one dimension left. You know, are you going to sever that one? You know, and that's out of our league. You know, we're not absolute. You know, even Michael is telling him that. You know, I'm not absolute. You know, you've got one dimension of connectivity left to the cosmos. Are you going to cut it? You know, and that's between you and the Father. Okay, so just note, I mean, I love the way they build these paragraphs, and to see, to begin to recognize how they're leading you and be able to be led by them like that so that you can see how they're building this picture.
Omnipotence does not imply the power to do the non-doable, the ungodlike act. Neither does omniscience imply the knowing of the unknowable. But such statements can hardly be made comprehensible to the finite mind. The creature can hardly understand the range and limitations of the will of the Creator.
Okay. But notice in there, you know, that's the thing that they're wondering. It's like, well, do you suppose that little sin segment is unknowable. Okay? It's like, well, isn't he the infinite father? You know, but, you know, they're trying to remind you, and there's always compossibility.
Can an individual have that much power they can hide it away even from God?
He's given them absolute free will in one, you know, relative to eternity. You know, in that regard, you're on the same level. So, you know,
we're equal.
Right. You know, it's not like he has an objective perspective on that. So you can say, this is the kind of things that's like, well, you suppose, you know, I mean, right. So they're wondering, you know, if that might be, you know, one of these unknowables, something that is a square circle. You know, when you talk about the compossibility. So not just non-doable, but, you know, there's also has to be the unknowable. What exactly? You know, like they're saying, you know. But such statements can hardly be made comprehensible to the finite mind. Okay, he's not just talking to us. I mean, he has a finite mind too, okay? I mean, he's speaking about himself too. He has a vast mind, but it's still finite. So, and it's not like he, you know, doesn't matter how many times he's stood in the very presence of the Father, you know, infinity is still way, you know, beyond his pay grade. So, all right. So, so now they've built up, you know, the omnipresence and the omnipotence and the omniscience. And so now just, they're going to, you know, put that together a little bit because, you know, all of those, all hyphen whatever, you know, sorts of things are, in some sense, a limitlessness. So let's see where they go here.
For God's limitlessness, the successive bestowal of himself upon the universes as they are brought into being in no wise lessens the potential of power or the store of wisdom as they continue to reside and repose in the central personality of deity. In potential of force, wisdom, and love, the Father has never lessened aught of his possession nor become divested of any attribute of his glorious personality as a result of the unstinted bestowal of himself upon the paradise sons, upon his subordinate creations, and upon the manifold creatures thereof.
Okay, one little thing I got to point out is it'll become obvious here as he goes forward. He's having a little fun here. He could have said they're brought into being, and in no manner lessen his potentials. But you know, notice what it is. So it in no wise lessens the store of wisdom. Okay, he purposely chose that expression because he's talking about wisdom, and this is kind of the key of what this is about. You have this omnipresence and this omnipotence and this omniscience, and all together, you know, what do you have? You have an all-wise nature. You know, combined with God is love, you know, and God is good, and you know, bringing that all together, you know, this harmony of all that, you know, being directly knowing every automaton, and you know, talk about facing facts, and you know, all that together. So that's he's very purposely trying to give you a clue, you know, that. You know, this is really about wisdom. Think about the wisdom part of what I'm talking about here. And I'm purposely going to use that expression in no wise to sort of stress that. All right, so keep going.
The creation of every new universe calls for a new adjustment of gravity. But even if creation should continue indefinitely, eternally, even to infinity, so that eventually the material creation would exist without limitations, still the power of control and coordination reposing in the Isle of Paradise would be found equal to and adequate for the mastery, control, and coordination of such an infinite universe. And subsequent to this bestowal of limitless force and power upon a boundless universe, the infinite would still be surcharged with the same degree of force and energy. The unqualified absolute would still be undiminished. God would still possess the same infinite potential, just as if force, energy, and power had never been poured forth from the endowment of universe upon universe. And so with wisdom. The fact that mind is so freely distributed to the thinking of the realms in no wise impoverishes the central source of divine wisdom. As the universes multiply and beings of the realms increase in number to the limit of comprehension, if mind continues without end to bestow upon these beings of high and low estate, still will God's central personality continue to embrace the same eternal, infinite, and all-wise mind.
Okay, so he did it again. He's the in no wise, with wisdom on each side of it. Okay, so think about what he's trying to add to your recognition about God's relationship to you. You know, I couldn't help but say it because it's just so automatic now. We all know that line from up there in Rodin, where, you know, you get a definition of wisdom. Now, you must face facts and adjust them to ideals in order to achieve wisdom. Okay, wisdom, you know, in a true sense, you know, is having both eyes open, both the universal controller eye and the universal father eye, for instance. And that whole bit about it, have you ever thought about that word that's in that, you know, in that passage from Rodin, face facts and adjust them to ideals. Remember how if you drop back here a little bit, let's see. Can I find it? Where is that? Wait a minute. It's not that far back. Oh yeah, here it is. Yeah. So it's in section two, where he says God adjusts, and they italicized it. God adjusts with the mind of imperfection, with your ancient mortals through the thought adjusters. So now rethink. See why they're called thought adjusters. Okay. This all wise aspect. Okay. He's facing facts and adjusting them to ideals. Okay, that thought adjuster is literally the spirit of goodness within you. It's a fragment of what ideals look like. Okay. And then just that way they word it, God adjusts with the mind of imperfection, the facts. He faces the facts and adjusts them to ideals. And so now you can think about why he does that. Why is he doing that? You know, we talked a lot of reasons about why God gives us a thought adjuster. You know, so it's eventually going to be our body. You know, it's a spirit fragment. We have to have a spirit body when we're first stage spirit, or on and on and on. You can talk about all these, you know, reasons for, you know, having a thought adjuster. But think about this one. You know that in order for God to be expressing, and he can't help but be expressing his all-wise nature, you know, this wisdom, you know, this, you know, when they talk about him as the source of divine wisdom, that's what you're seeing. You're seeing an expression of his divine wisdom. Literally, facts have been faced. He's grabbed a hold of you with the universal controller hand. And then he's bestowing this fragment of the infinite upholder. You know, it's adjusting with those facts, facing facts and adjusting them to ideals, because he is the source of divine wisdom. You're seeing wisdom playing out in that relationship, It's literally a direct expression of the wisdom of God made, you know, literally manifest, energetically manifest. These two energy systems are expressing that wisdom. Yeah.
If I look at your map here, it actually says righteousness. So am I to also do good, or do I also need to do righteously?
Well, no, I mean, I'm the when I say the spirit of goodness, that's not on the chart here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's you know, we think about these beginning threefold actuality patterns, and once you have the three intuitions in the Holy Spirit, and then you have the Spirit of Truth, once you get to the bring full personality character into play, you can think of a new threefold pattern on that follows that. In that next higher level of that threefold pattern, the Holy Spirit is the Spirit of Fact, and the Spirit of Truth is the Spirit of Truth, and then the Thought Adjuster is the Spirit of Goodness, and you have that threefold engagement of you as a full personal phenomenon of fact, truth, and goodness to give you a reality response, a direct linkage to that threefold actuality on that highest level within your consciousness, fact, truth, and goodness. That's what's between the lines here. I mean, that's why he's so stressing it, and you know, and he knows it wasn't that far back that, you know, he purposely italicized that adjust, and he's hoping that you're keeping that in mind and putting two and two together. If we've even pointed out, you know, when we see mind now, we think about mind in a whole new way in terms of this relationship between the adjuster and your mind, you know, and the adjuster being within your mind rather than next to or above or whatever your mind, but literally being within it. You know, when we think about the universal absolute, you know, that individuality viewpoint designation for that fact as the reservoir of, you know, the literal mind energy that, you know, your consciousness is utilizing. From the individuality viewpoint, it's the reservoir of that mind energy. From the unity viewpoint, it's the infinite upholder. And literally a fragment of that infinite upholder is the thought adjuster. I mean, so, you know, you have a thought adjuster and you have the reservoir of mind. I mean, from the source point, the thought adjuster is in the mind. Nothing has changed. Okay? From an eternity viewpoint. That's why that adjuster can be within your mind, because it's of the same thing that mind is. And it really brings in, again, this appreciation that the individuality viewpoint and unity viewpoint aren't just two, sort of limited perspectives on things. They both literally are part of what's going on simultaneously. And, you know, again, like they constantly reminded us up there in the Supreme Papers, you have to think about both at the same time in order to understand how this really works. Because only then can you begin to transcend your limitations a bit and start to see things as they really are from a unity and an eternity viewpoint, from a source viewpoint. And the more that you challenge yourself to see things like that, the easier it is for your adjuster to foster that. Because the adjuster, that's where the adjuster's consciousness is. You know, his consciousness, that divine self that's coming down, I mean, he has a fundamentally top-down viewpoint. That's what he can help you with. Your very basal animal origin bottom-up viewpoint is not a heck of a lot that he can even relate to there. I mean, so much so that normally you have to get that bottom-up phenomenon clear up to the supreme level, up to a third circler, before, you know, he has any relationship to you and can come. You know, if it wasn't for the Spirit of Truth bridging the gap. So, So he's, you know, this is what he wants to bring in, is is thinking about wisdom and how much additional understanding comes into play about things like the adjuster when you think about it very literally and factually, face facts and adjust them to ideals in order for him to express his wisdom. All right, take another one.
The fact that he sends forth spirit messengers from himself to indwell the men and women of your world and other worlds in no wise lessens his ability to function as a divine and all-powerful spirit personality. And there is absolutely no limit to the extent or number of such spirit monitors which he can and may send out. This giving of himself to his creatures creates a boundless, almost inconceivable future possibility of progressive and successive existences for these divinely endowed mortals. And this prodigal distribution of himself as these ministering spirit entities in no manner diminishes the wisdom and perfection of truth and knowledge which repose in the person of the all-wise, all-knowing, and all-powerful Father.
Wait, stop there. Okay, so you notice three times, okay, in no wise. Okay. But here, he doesn't do it a fourth time. He says, in no manner diminishes the wisdom. He didn't say, again, in no wise diminishes the wisdom. Okay, just kind of step back and just think about, what's going on there. I mean, he's obviously pushing it a bit here. With this all wise. Okay, so he's being very pedagogical here, but he's not pedantic. He doesn't go over the line. Okay. He's using wisdom in talking about wisdom. See that? There's all these just delightful little things that you can notice once you see how he's doing this. All right. But to say it a fourth time, especially immediately in front of the word wisdom, that just wouldn't be wise. He could have said it no matter all four times, but all right, yeah. But and just notice, okay, we were reading that previous paragraph, and it's like, okay, I know what's going on here. This is about the adjusters. That's what he's getting at here. And so what's the next paragraph? About the adjusters, of course. And to have the thrill when you can begin to engage the book, where you read that paragraph that starts, and so with wisdom, and you stop and you reflect on it and you get it, and sure enough, that's exactly where it takes you next. That's what you're looking for. You're following the thread of truth through the book then. You've struck step with the truth. You know where he's going. You've picked up on his clues, And he's succeeded in his effort to challenge you to cultivate enough of a consciousness that has enough of a relationship to the adjuster that there's some hope that anything that he's doing is going to sink in. Remember how he told us that up front. You go, wow, that's pretty cool. I maybe I'm starting to get this a little bit. That's what we're looking for, to really see how it flows. And then once you're in that flow, you start to notice all of the subtle things, where he's demonstrating that he has the wisdom to push it, but not to be mechanical and go into pedantic, et cetera, like that. So, all right, let's take another one here.
To the mortals of time, there is a future, but God inhabits eternity. Even though I hail from near the very abiding place of deity, I cannot presume to speak with perfection of understanding concerning the infinity of many of the divine attributes. Infinity of mind alone can fully comprehend infinity of existence an eternity of action.
Okay, so there he just puts it right out. Yeah, to confront that first sentence. To the mortals of time, there's a future, but not to God. That's a meaningless word to God. Okay, how many humans have had a notion of God throughout all of history that, you know, that had God that transcendent, where, you know, he doesn't have a future. He doesn't have a notion of your future. There is no such thing. God inhabits eternity. That's the real God. You know, that's the real God, the Father. And you have to firmly make God the Father like that so that there's room for the rest of God. Like God the Supreme. You know, so that there's room for the answer to a number of conundrums that have been plaguing humans, where they've been trying to get God the Father to be the answer to two things that fundamentally can't have the same answer. You know, there's these two questions, and humans have been trying to say, oh, God the Father is the answer to both those questions. No, that's illogical. For instance, you know, like, how can God be both transcendence and immanence? He can't be both. He has to be one or the other if he's going to be logical, you know, if reality is going to be logical. You know, how could God be infinite and finite? He can't be both. Well, yeah, he can. He's, because he's magical. No. You know, there wouldn't be a God if he was magical. You know, the only, you know, there's a God because there's logic, and there's logic because there's God. They're one and the same thing. The universe is inherently logical. Now, that is the fact of God. You know, if you don't believe in a logical reality, then, you know, then what the heck is there a need for a God?
Spockhead, right?
Yeah, yes.
So, which God is this then? Because I read somewhere back here that God grows as we grow.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can understand that growing in many ways. I mean, now, literally, you know, the Father is not an evolutionary, experiential deity. So the Father's not in that sense. Remember, they talked about that a little bit, just, you know, it was a previous paper, I think, you know, helping us understand a little bit how God God the Father strikes step with our temporal nature. But in terms of intimate, you know, relationship to our growing nature, I mean, that's God the Supreme and all of the finite experiential deity that's within God the Supreme. That's very much, you know, God the, you know, from a time viewpoint, God the Supreme is growing with us. You know, especially the God the Almighty aspect of God the Supreme, that's in direct synchrony with all the growth of all person, you know, things and beings. You know, all being upheld by the God, the Mother aspect of the Supreme. You know, that's, you know, again, why it's so important to begin to have that God as immanence notion, i.e. God the Mother, an individuality of the whole. The aspect of, you know, the overarching aspect of God that remains within when he freed himself from the fetters of unqualified infinity, something that can be there intimately with you. And then, like I was saying, when you start to think about that on the finite level, you recognize, as we, you know, as we followed their lead going through the Supreme Papers, that you have these two aspects of that intimate within time with you, God. There's the part that really expresses the transcendence directly so that it can uphold the whole. And then there's the more part-like aspect, the summation. You know, there's the focalizer and the summarizer. There's this, the focalization and the summation. There's the Mother and the Almighty. You know, so that you have an aspect that is more directly expressive of the Father, the part that's directly in the sevenfold, God the Father downstepped, you know, and engaging the things and beings in time, you know, in that, I don't have it with me here, but, you know, my little, you know, chart of the sevenfold, you know, you have the Supreme Being on the, as one of the sevenfold creators, and the Almighty Supreme is one of the sevenfold controllers. You know, those are coming down from the two aspects of God the Father, the Universal Father and the Universal Controller. But that, you know, but they're always, but then there's that third column, you know, to the side, there's, to the side, there's the hierarchy of mothers. Because all of that engaging by God the sevenfold has to be happening in a domain that's being upheld, and you know we're going to get to that. It's where this section is actually going here, too. You'll see how he sums this up. Anyway, so you know, not to belabor that anymore, but just I mean, yeah, always ask yourself when they're you know, when they tell you up in the foreword that if they just say God, like especially up in the front part of the book here, most of the time that's short for God the Father, if they just say God. But that's not always. There's lots and lots of places in the book where they just say God, you know, and if you recognize what's going on, you know that they're not talking about God the Father there. Sometimes they're directly talking about God the Mother, for instance. Like, you know, when they say that between here and paradise, you're God seeking. God the whom? No, seeking. You're seeking God the Father. Between here and paradise, you're God the Father. You know, but it doesn't say God the Father. It just says God seeking. So you have to say, well, God the whom? God the absolute? God the, you know, I mean, you know, it's like, oh, well, I'm God the Father seeking. You know? But then it says, in the second half of your finite career, as a finaliter, you're God revealing. And you've got to ask yourself a question, like, God the whom revealing? It's like, well, I'm not going to be like a creator son. I mean, he who has seen me has seen the Father. I can't be God the Father revealing. And I certainly am not God the Supreme revealing. I'm trying to get that. It's, you know, my seventh stage spirit, you know, endpoint. I'm trying to get to God the Supreme. So I'm not God the Supreme revealing. What am I? I'm God the Mother revealing. That's why I have trinitization abilities. You know, I have a relationship to God the Mother. I don't have a relationship to God the Father. I don't create creature trinitized sons. They aren't creature created sons. I'm not doing a Father thing there. I'm doing a Mother thing there. You know, they're creature trinitized sons. You know, so you're a trinitizer, but you're not a creator. See, you know, so again, I mean, you put it all together. So yeah, you have to always, you know, they are by no means pedantic, you know, and a lot of those sorts of things. They, you know, they're not going to lead you around by a nose ring. They're trying to get you to recognize, and they're very careful. You know, and we've talked about this. They've constructed it so initially it's not jarring. You can easily sort of have a God the Father notion that sort of does everything. You know, and you can read the book, and it all kind of works. You can easily skip the stuff that doesn't quite fit into that picture, and there's plenty of stuff that's carefully worded so that you can easily, you know, ball it in, you know, and it's like, okay, God the Father, he does everything just like I always thought, you know. But when you start looking closely, you go, oh, and look at there. There where they mean the Father, they said it, but there they didn't say it, and I know why. Because that's God the Supreme. That's not God the Father, or you know, or that's God the Mother. That's not God the Father. They very carefully word it so that once you're ready to recognize the more subtle aspects of reality, it's all precisely there. And you know, and when they, You know, they don't, you know, every time that they're talking about the universal mother, they don't say the universal mother, but they might say the cosmic presence, you know, of God the Supreme or something like that. You know, and you need to fill in the blank. Oh, and so, all right, so let's see. So meanwhile, back to, so you've got this, you know, again, see, like he's admitting, he, you know, he's finite just like we are, and not all of this is clear to him either. I cannot presume to speak with perfection of understanding concerning the infinity of many things. But that whole bit about to just really say it to the mortals of time, there is a future. Just stop and think about what a challenging little statement that is. You know, and you're it's like, I mean, I don't have a future. I mean, you know, the way they word it is purposely meant to kind of stop you, you know, and they're trying to get you to not, you know, to hold them both. You have a future, but God doesn't relate to you in that way. Both are true. You don't have to give up your future in order to have a relationship with God, and God doesn't have to give up eternity in order to have a relationship with you. He dwells within in eternity, and you dwell in time, and yet there is a linkage of complete intimacy through the mystery of mysteries. You know, eternity and time strike step.
Bringing in with this creature created, where we're mm-hmm. so used to that orientation being a lowly creature mm-hmm. orientation, but there's something else going on there, because creatures do something with mom that's different from creators, and creators can actually look at creatures and have the same sort of, do you guys know really what right. that's all about?
Right.
Not so simplistically above and below, like
right. I mean, yeah, sure. You know, in a very circumscribed temporal viewpoint, as an animal origin creature, that's pretty lowly.
Yeah.
But you know, in eternity, you are so much more than that. You know, even related to some of the things we were talking about, bringing up the absolute, you know, dimension of your personality and just what that means. Even when you're, I mean, you know, think about pre-Pentecost. I mean, you know, you don't have a spirit of truth or a thought adjuster or anything like that, but you have a personality with an absolute dimension to it.
Yeah.
Even then, a primitive human has that.
Yeah.
He's already given that primitive human a direct relationship to absoluteness. You know, I mean, that's a lot more than a lowly animal origin blob of molecules. You know, that's something pretty amazing when you start to think about the consequences of that. Okay.
Mortal man cannot possibly know the infinitude of the Heavenly Father. Finite mind cannot think through such an absolute truth or fact. But this same finite human being can actually feel, literally experience, the full and undiminished impact of such an infinite Father's love. Such a love can be truly experienced, albeit while quality of experience is unlimited, quantity of such an experience is strictly limited by the human capacity for spiritual receptivity and by the associated capacity to love the Father in return.
Okay, so notice it starts out just what I was just saying before we started reading there again, that absolute dimension of that personality. Okay, yes, you know, you cannot, in terms of your ability to wrap your mind around extent, around magnitude, you know, infinite magnitude, the magnitude of infinity, the infinitude of the Heavenly Father. Okay, no. You know, your finite and absentite dimensions are not going to wrap around such. But you have that absolute dimension, and that's what they're reminding you of here. that can directly engage quality-wise the absoluteness of the Father. If you allow the word love to be reformed, redefined, made new, like they're challenging us here, hence them capitalizing it like that to remind us what they're talking about there. You know, notice that, you know, they give it in all caps, i.e., you know, note the definition as herein challenged, such a love. See, is the next words. Yeah. Okay. Only such a love can be truly experienced. You know, that Father's love, and the true Father's love, that absolute love, you have access to the quality of that love because of that absolute facet of, you know, dimension of your personality. Okay, so there's the Father part of the picture. That's the initiator, like I've said a number of times. The first thing that you do with that personality gift that the Father gives you is you use that absolute facet, now that absolute dimension, to initiate yourself. I am. Yeah. And then from here to eternity, you're trying to fill out the finite and absentite dimensions. Okay. And what's that about? Notice the words. Albeit, while quality of experience is unlimited, you know, and that's an absolute dimension. It's not relative, okay? Quantity of such an experience is strictly limited by the human capacity. Is the Father the source of capacity? No. The mother is the source of capacity. You know? The mother is the association of the infinite capacity, the infinite potential, and the infinite upholder, downstepped to the appropriate level. From her, you get capacity. You know, the first direct demonstration of that we were just talking about. She encircuits you in her Holy Spirit ministry. It literally gives you a measure of capacity. It carves out your heart within your mind, a temple, you know, of your being. You know, it is a literal place, a space, a volume, a capacity, because she can give you capacity. And you know, we've talked about, you know, that you know, when you think about it in the hourglass and that upper domain. You know, the temple, you know, it has, you initially can think of it as having three stories because of the three intuitions. It literally, you know, it's not two-dimensional, it's three-dimensional. It has volume, it has capacity.
Government can be made to where it helps individuals within that government with that capacity creation in their lives.
Right. See, when you start to reflect on the insight that's inherent in the founding of this nation, this whole bit about, you know, that we've tried to bring up about supplying the favorable conditions, that's one of the fundamental elements of recognition that is attempting to be institutionalized. To establish a government that fosters favorable conditions for God-conscious citizens to grow and maintain such an audacious experiment. Can man so consecrate himself that he can take on this additional measure of self-governance, that he will supply the favorable conditions within, and he will construct a system without that reflects that further fostering of those favorable conditions for growth. You know, that it's about giving you the favorable conditions to pursue happiness, not giving you so-called happiness, which of course is impossible because happiness is a choice.
Well, what I hear, favorable conditions is attention. There has to be tensions, and you have to learn to accept those tensions.
Right. What
not
is
try to eliminate them by eliminating one side or the other side.
You see what what are we talking about here? What is the next section in this book? The inevitabilities. Okay? About the tension. Recognizing, embracing the tension. Not imagining it away or whatever. Reality is in the tensions of the inevitabilities.
That's what creates the capacity.
All right. I mean, there's two things here. See, that this whole... You know, they're saying there's this whole relationship to the Father, you know, that requires, you know, that involves a fact that's so transcendent they have to capitalize, you know, use all caps for the word love to try to remind you to really push your thoughts, you know, beyond anything you've had before. That fact, L-O-V-E, all caps, is strictly limited. The Father has limited himself in relationship to you. He's pulled himself out of the whole. You're in the whole. This distinction is vital for in a cosmic system, okay? I mean, you're within that whole and he's pulled out. So that means he's self-limited. There are rules about how he can reach in. Can't just do anything because he's on the outside. He's not in. Okay, and so it's strictly limited, you know, by the human capacity for spiritual receptivity. If you have no receiver, you know, if the size of your temple within is very, very small, don't expect to be receiving much. You know, if you want to listen to the whispers of the distant galaxies, you need to build a really, really big radio dish. Okay, the still small voice is not going to be heard with your little, you know, dish network dish, okay? You need the Arecibo receiver, okay? You need to expand your capacity. You have to consecrate your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother. You need to grow that temple within. But not grow it. You need to allow it to be grown. You need to supply favorable conditions for growth.
And you need to cooperate with other human beings because our Arecibo was not built by one person.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And, you know, if we're in a cosmic system, you know, think about those words again. And then, you know, the rest of it too. And by the associated capacity to love the Father in return, you would love to be able to love the Father to the, you know, as to the limits of your imagination, you know, and especially if you can wrap your mind around what they're talking about with L-O-V-E, all caps. But forget about it. It's not going to happen if all you've got is this tiny little capacity to love and return. You know, and the Father does not, your relationship to the Father, you can consecrate your will. See, what are you consecrating? You're consecrating relative to this quality, not to the quantity. You know, the consecration of your will to the perfect will of God the Father gets the quality in play. The quantity is the consecration of your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother. That's the other part of the picture. And see how they refer to that here. Let me read this last paragraph.
Finite appreciation of infinite qualities far transcends the logically limited capacities of the creature because of the fact that mortal man is made in the image of God. There lives within him a fragment of infinity. Therefore, man's nearest and dearest approach to God is by and through love, for God is love. And all of such a unique relationship is an actual experience in cosmic sociology. The creator creature relationship, the father-child affection.
Okay,
So they did it again. Look at how they're both in this last paragraph again. You know, so they take it up a notch. Okay, yeah, you have that absolute dimension of your personality, but you know, it's even more than that. The Father's also given you another gift. You know, so your ability to appreciate infinite qualities far transcends the logically limited capacities of creature, you know, because of the fact that the mortal man is made in the image of God, that it lives with him in a fragment of infinity. Okay, that thought adjuster, you know, is even going to amplify this quality relationship all the more, like they're saying, infinite qualities. Because it's the spirit of goodness. Yeah, it's about quality. Okay? But look at how they end that. Notice, you know, so you have this, you know, and of course they, you know, they bring it in, you know, approach to God is by and through love. You have all of this powerful Father expression, but notice how they say, and all of such a unique relationship. So everything that they've just gotten you to be swept up in, this vast sphere of the love of the Father with this absolute quality and all this, all of such unique relationship is an actual experience in cosmic sociology. This distinction is vital. For in a cosmic system, the individual members are not connected with each other, except in relation to the whole and through the individuality of the whole. That includes your relationship to the Father. They're reminding you that even when you talk about the Father engaging you, okay, you're inside the whole, he's outside the whole, he reaches in. Can he touch you without going through the mother to get to you? No, she fills the whole. Okay?
But you have a direct relationship. You have
Think about it. No. Yeah, yes and no. In the quality, but the quantity part. Okay, we all know a very simple example of this. In our local universe, we have a mother and a father. Think about their relationship. 2,000 years ago, Master Michael poured out his spirit of truth upon all flesh, engaging each of us directly as a quality. Now, technically, how does that spirit of truth get poured out on all flesh? It's on the substrate, the spirit substrate of the mother. Michael can only get the spirit of truth to you via the creative mother spirit. He can't do it all by himself because he's not ubiquitous. He's not a spirit presence upon which he can put his personal modulation of truth in unification. It's true in the local universe, and it's also true. I mean, this is what I've been trying to get, you know, everyone to recognize. To recognize, you know, as below, so above. It's the same way all the way to infinity. You know, if you start in some conceptualization where you have God the infinite and you drop down, you know, you don't drop down in a single line to God the Father. You drop down, God the infinite becomes God as transcendence and God as immanence. Because see, in God the infinite, in the concept of God the infinite, there is no inside and outside. There's only God the infinite. Okay? There is no other. There's nothing. All there is God the infinite. You know? Inside, outside, every side, every way, you know, one thing, God the infinite. You know, the moment that you come down a notch and have an inside and an outside, you have a God the Father and God the Mother. And that's true all the way. In order for this, for God the sevenfold to come down, it has to be in parallel to the Mother. The two go hand in hand. That which is reaching in to engage is doing it within a domain that's upheld by the Mother. Doesn't matter if you're talking about the local universe, the grand universe, the master universe, you know, or the cosmos infinite, okay? It all is. So to just see that whole thing about it, it's an actual experience in cosmic sociology, the creature or the creator-creature relationship. I mean, you have this whole, in relation to the whole and through the individuality of the whole in general. And within that, there's this father-child affection. Okay. But just, and again, just notice, like I said, how they word this. You can easily have this be quite gentle. You know, they purposely put father-child affection. It's like, oh, yeah, just like Jesus told me. You can take it as a very much of a baby step from the fourth epical revelation, the way he's written it. But if you look more closely, it's like, but cosmic sociology? What the heck? Does that have to do with that thing that Jesus talked about, that father-child affection? See, he's trying to throw in a little bit more. But you do notice how he ends. The last word is affection. He's trying to remind, when he was trying to teach you how to start thinking about this new word love, that it's a doingness, it's a verb, it's facera, the root of affection, it's to do, it's something that that you and God are doing. If it's love, all caps, it's not something that you're feeling, in spite of the fact that they've had the word feel there, but he put it in italics purposely and put a parenthetical, literally experience. No, we're not, he's saying, not level of feelings sort of feel, but, touch experientially, within your mind.
The Father's love is there whether you experience it or not.
Right, yep. And just recognizing that through the individuality of the whole, we're not only connected one to the other, but we're connected, that one to this other. The Father's link to you is also part of the cosmic system.
The Father's outside of the individuality of the whole. How can that
be? Right. Well, yes, he's outside, but the adjuster is with inside, and the personality is expressing inside. The points of the Father's manifestation are within. That's the whole question. See, how does he get himself within? She's the way. Remember, there's the Father's will, and then there's the Father's way. She is his way within. Like we tried to point out when we were going through the Supreme Papers, and they tried to, get you to think about that, that it's on her hand that you actually tread. Okay, all right, so let's wrap her up here. But I just wanted you to notice that it's interesting. See that he brings in the mother in between the lines there in those last two paragraphs quite a bit. And where does he do it? He doesn't do it, in the previous three sections. He does it here when he's bringing in wisdom, and definitely when we get all the way down to the local universe, when we talk about wisdom, our first thought is the spirit of wisdom, a facet of adjutant mind bestowed upon us by the Creator Son? No. Bestowed on us by the Creator Mother Spirit. See, just think about that. He is, it says right up here, he's the central source of divine wisdom. But by the time that source of wisdom is bestowed and actually touches us, it's coming from the Creative Mother Spirit, immediately. So by the time the he gets what he wants to give to you, he reaches you as a she. See? Just like we've talked about so many times. I mean, the Supreme Being encompasses the finite. He's outside. Okay? For the he, the Supreme Being, to get to you personally, He has to go within, and when he does that, he fills the hole. He's not a point. He's not a he-like phenomenon anymore. He's a she-like phenomenon. See, that's the other way to think about this father-mother. I mean, you know, the father initiated the mother, and if you want to think about it, you know, in the sense of, you know, the mother is the absolute upholder, the absolute upholder, the finite upholder. What initiated that? The infinite upholder, the father. So it's another way to think about it. You know, the father drew himself outside and then re-engaged. But when he does that, he doesn't come in as a he. He comes in as something that fills the hole, that's ubiquitous. He comes in as a she. I mean, but of course, see, you're not really using him. You know, there you should drop the father and mother. Just say God. God pulled himself out and then re-engaged. And so that one God now has two aspects, an outside part called God the Father and an inside part called God the Mother. But it's one God.
Just like the adjuster reaching in and then becoming experiential, developing an experiential nature.
Right. You have the existential, God the Father, existential deity. God the Mother, experiential deity. I mean, that you know you have those two. That's, you know, that's the godness of those, the godness of existential deity overarching is God the Father. The godness of experiential deity is God the Mother. Specifically, you know, you have a hierarchy, you know, of father and mother and whatnot, and then you even have the two coming together. You know, Father like God the Almighty, Mother like God the Mother, coming together as God the Supreme. You know, and all these, see, it's very complex when you start thinking about the details. But just as a general thing, just recognize that that's what you're finally doing is you're getting the action of God differentiated. You know, into two aspects: God is transcendence and God is immanence. You know, and you're just using the word God. It's God, one God. But then you recognize that you can think about those two facets rather than blurring it all together. There is a boundary. And so you can talk about the facet that's within and the facet that's without. God the Father and God the Mother. That's all you mean by God the Mother. It's the part of God that you used to call God the Father along with the part of his transcendence, and that made the whole picture illogical. Because somehow now you had this individuality, because you're always thinking in individuality terms, and somehow the individual was outside and inside, and that was, you know, the Lord works in mysterious ways. That's the only thing we could ever come up with. It's like, no, there's one God, but when you think of it from a unity viewpoint instead of an individuality viewpoint, you can talk about it clearly. God the Father, God the Mother. All right. So next time we'll get into the inevitabilities. And we're going to, I know I teased it last time, but I definitely decided not to go into it tonight, the whole bit about equity and equality, because I remembered as I look forward, oh yes, it's right there in altruism. Is altruism desirable? They use the word inequality. So let's use that as a great point, you know, and it's even social inequality, the expression that they bring in there. So let's use that as the point where we'll talk about that difference between equity and equality and see if we can get a better handle on that, you know, what exactly they're telling us in that particular instance. Let's take a moment here.